Today on Straight Talk Africa, we look at the significance of press freedom in Africa. That discussion is coming up next right here on Straight Talk Africa. Hello, welcome to Straight Talk Africa, live from the Voice of America headquarters here in Washington. I am Sheikha Sali, and today we are discussing the significance of the freedom of the press in Africa. Across Africa, young people are standing up to the abuse of power by mobilizing widespread protests against their respective governments. Some longtime leaders are becoming fearful of the uprisings and are hitting back by stifling freedom of speech and shutting down access to the internet. My colleague Paul Ndiho has more.
In its annual report, a Freedom House, an independent watchdog group dedicated to the freedom of expression, freedom of the press and democracy around the world, says democracy is in retreat in 2019. John Tamin, the director of Africa programs at Freedom House, appearing on VOA's Straight Talk Africa, says Angola and Ethiopia are expressing a commitment to much needed reforms.
The picture for Africa is a mixed one. There are some concerning countries, and I think we're going to talk about those. But I also do want to point out that there are some real good stories coming out of the continent this last year, and two countries in particular, Ethiopia and also Angola.
Zimbabwe's status has improved from not free to partly free category because of the 2018 presidential election, though flawed, granted a degree of legitimacy to the rule of President Emmerson Mnangagwa, as young people advocate for democratic values, self-determination, and freedoms in Sudan. The determined push led to the recent ouster of former leader Omar al-Bashir. Despite some gains, several of the continent's aging authoritarian leaders continue to cling on to power. In Cameroon, President Paul Biya, now in office for 36 years, was re-elected after presiding over elections in 2018 that were marred by allegations of fraud and low voter turnout. In Uganda, long-time leader President Yoweri Museveni's regime in office for 32 years oversaw the removal of a presidential age cap from the constitution, allowing him to run for a sixth term in 2021. He has also sought to curb dissent by arresting opposition leaders Dr. Kizza Besigye and pop star turned politician Bobi Wine. The rights group Internet Without Borders says efforts by governments across Africa to deliberately sever online access to silence dissent over various issues is on the rise.
It's worrying because it's not just an internet shutdown. It's a triggering of more serious human rights violations.
In its 2019 Press Freedom Report, the right of freedom of expression and free media remains in jeopardy in Burundi. In March, Burundian authorities charged three schoolgirls with defacing a picture of President Pierre Nkurunziza. In another development, that Voice of America and the British Broadcasting Corporation are both barred from broadcasting in Burundi. In March, Burundi's media regulator, the National Communications Council, announced that withdrawn the operating license for the BBC and renewed its suspension of the VOA. In Rwanda, censorship and self-censorship is the norm rather than the exception. Rwanda's Supreme Court last week repealed a law that banned the publication of political cartoons while upholding another that punishes any person who insults or defames the president of the republic. Breaking this law could land the person in prison for at least 5 years. In South Africa, however, people are optimistic about their press freedom.
To be free also means we must exercise not just our right but our responsibility to wake up and elect leaders.
Ghanaian journalist Eugene Salam Owusu says perhaps without a free press, there would be no democracy in Ghana.
It is owing to this absolute press freedom in Ghana that the country has been touted over the years as the beacon of democracy and stability in Africa.
Freedom House has ranked the Central African Republic, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, South Sudan, Equatorial Guinea, and Eritrea among the worst performing countries in 2019. Paul Ndiho, VOA News.
Thanks, Paul, for that report. Joining us here in the studio are three distinguished guests. Amanda Bennett, Director of the Voice of America, Professor Nicholas Boas, teaches at the Department of Communications at the University of the District of Columbia, and John Temin, Director of the Africa Program at Freedom House. I have to say, lady and gentlemen, that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the three of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're most welcome. Let me come to you, Amanda. What is the specific mission of the Voice of America, an institution that you head?
Voice of America is two things. One, it is the, and for some cases, the only source of reputable, fact-based, independent journalism and news in many, many parts of the world. It's also, for many parts of the world, it represents the very idea that a free press can exist. So you see in many of the countries we just looked at that the free press does not exist. Without the Voice of America, no one has a model for what a free press could look like.
How do you respond to some critics who say that, on the contrary, you are looking at an institution that is a propaganda mouthpiece of the United States government?
It's one of the wonderful things about Voice of America, because while we are government funded, we are not government controlled. And we are completely separate from the U.S. government. As a matter of fact, we're separated by law. There is a very powerful set of laws that separate us that mean that we cannot and do not have to take direction from anyone else. And there also is, as you well know, a very powerful culture of independence and press freedom within Voice of America, because many of the people that work here have come from places that don't have a free press, and they know the difference.
As a matter of fact, I sometimes, tell some of my friends and critics that I am a very, very lucky guy in the sense that Voice of America pays me for doing some of the stuff that I could otherwise have, in fact, done pro bono, having discussions about issues that are pertinent to all of us.
We're very, very lucky to be here in a place where we can practice our profession freely and fully.
Very interesting. So if, in fact, it is true, as you said and as I say, that we are an independent international media organization, any particular reason, for example, why we are not broadcast, we are not seen, we do not interact with the Republic of Burundi?
Well, we would love to do all of those things with the Republic of Burundi. But unfortunately, as you just saw, the government of Burundi has essentially thrown us out along with the British Broadcasting Corporation. Both of us were not permitted to broadcast inside Burundi together at the same time. So we think Burundi deserves to have the same access to free press that other countries do, so we would very much like to be back there.
What about their concern that there is an individual Burundian journalist who works for the Voice of America who, in their words, participated in the 2015 failed coup, which was aimed at toppling the incumbent president Pierre Nkurunziza and his government, and that particular individual, as a matter of fact, is the subject of an arrest warrant?
Well, we've asked for that arrest warrant and haven't yet seen it, so we're not sure what they're talking about, and that individual is a member in good standing of VOA's press corps, and he's following all our regulations. He's practicing good journalism. We haven't seen anything that would say that there's anything whatsoever wrong with him working here.
How do you find the Voice of America? You've been here for quite some time so far.
I am so proud and so happy to be working here. I have a long journalistic career. I've worked at many, many large national news agencies, news organizations around the country. And I have to say that the passion that this inspires, both in me and in everyone else around, is just wonderful.
If you could put your fingers on one thing, what is it, for example, that you would consider to be the single most important decision that you have made so far regarding the freedom of press?
I think there's a couple of decisions. I can't point to one single one, but you mentioned the separation of the government, making sure that issue stays in the forefront of everyone's mind here at Voice of America, that they cherish it and protect it the way it should be protected. That is the thing that distinguishes us from propaganda organs, the separation from government. So making sure that is properly respected is one of them. And the other, I have to say, is working to open up the voices of the women that are in this building, because you can't have a free country, a free democracy, if half the people in the world are underrepresented or repressed. So I'd say those two things.
What about the single most important, regrettable decision?
You know, I hate to say this, but I have no regrets so far. It's been nothing but wonderful.
Really?
Absolutely.
When you compare the other institutions that you worked for as a journalist, when you compare and contrast with the Voice of America, what would you say that you have learned from this particular institution so far that you probably didn't see at the other places?
I wish every journalist would have the opportunity to learn what I've learned, because I learned at great institutions that had terrific standards and we really appreciated the freedom that we had, but none of us here in the United States appreciate that freedom enough. And I wish that other journalists would have the opportunity to see what I've seen and go to countries and see what a difference it makes when a country has a free press or when it does not. You can see that in a country without a free press, it is virtually impossible for democracy to exist. So for me, the appreciation of what I have has something that VOA has brought to me.
Professor Nicholas Boaz, you are a journalist in your own right. You have a journalism degree from the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. You are a professor of communications. Do you have any particular question that you'd like to put to Amanda?
Well, let me say this, Amanda. This phenomenon of stifling free press in Africa, maybe not only Africa, in other parts of the world, has been there for quite some time. And is there a way that we can find to stop this machination or plot of really stifling free press? Because as you know, and all of us know here, that the free press is significant to enhancing independence as well as development. So if there's no independent account of events from independent media, then we may be playing the hands of dictators here. So what do you think? What should the world, or what should Africa really do? Because that's part of their, it's part and parcel of their democracy here.
Well, you've heard some of the answers here. Is that the people of Africa need to demand a free press, demand access to a free press. And you've started to see that this is happening. And I have to say also that I have nothing but the utmost respect for the brave journalists in Africa who continue to do their profession in the face of, you know, some very great dangers. So continuing to show what the difference is, I think, is one of the things that we can do.
Okay. Well, for me, this has been a struggle over the years, because we've been reading this every now and then. We revisit the topic and nothing more significant really comes. But I think it's true when you see people in different nations of Africa protesting and demanding to have that free right to be heard, to say whatever they think is right or is wrong. Because most of the part, in most of African countries, they really look for good things. You've got to say something nice for the government, not being critical. And being critical is part of being a nationalist, because you really want to know what's going on. And when you do that, you get labeled as an opposition or somebody who does not really want to spearhead development in a country. I don't know. I think communication is essential here. In every aspect of the world, it's very essential for people either to disagree or agree. But in the end, then, they are able to make conflict management here, try to at least to come to a position instead of just labeling others as not loving the country or things like that. So there's this distortion of how leaders really play and attack the free press.
Nicholas, unfortunately, time happens not to be our best ally. Let me ask Amanda perhaps the last question, because she has to go to some other important schedules.
Okay.
Amanda, there has been, of course, what has been dubbed as the liberalization of the media, especially on the African continent. If true, to what extent do institutions such as Voice of America remain relevant in terms of covering the African continent?
In terms of in places where there's been liberalization of
right,
the press?
Right.
Well, I think these liberalizations, I think, as we've just heard, are still very fragile. And I think being an example or being a support or being a help to these growing movements of press freedom, I think is very, very important. So, no, we're not gonna pull out and run.
How do you respond to some government officials on the continent who say that institutions such as the Voice of America, the BBC, tend to be supportive more of the opposition rather than the government?
Well, remember, knowledge is power. And the governments are trying to keep that knowledge away from people. They have the ability to give that knowledge and that power or keep it as they want. We're looking at the ones who don't have the access to that power. And so it's natural that we would try and look to bring the stories out of the people whose stories have been repressed.
Mm.
That would be natural.
I know that you have been to a couple or even several countries on the African continent. You have met senior government officials, you met media operators, you met journalists, civil society, and what have you. What message did you get from them when you were interacting with them? Were you assured, for example, that the Voice of America, the BBCs of the world are still relevant? They still provide and play an effective role in terms of helping to build democracy?
I think as we've heard from our colleague and we know from Freedom House, I think that Voice of America and BBC and other free press are actually more relevant than they've ever been before, because despite the liberalization of the press in some places, the trend you're seeing right now is the closing of the media space. So I think our role is actually more critical than ever.
Very interesting. Well, unfortunately, time is not our best ally. I would like to thank the VOA director, Amanda Bennett, for being with us today. But she has to leave for another engagement. You are tuned into Straight Talk Africa. We'll have more of a discussion in a moment, so please don't go away, because we'll be right back with you. Thank you very
much. Vincent Macquarie, inviting you to the new look, Africa 54, premiering soon. Same great team, but with new energy and a new host, Esther Gbuyiwot.
Hi, and welcome. We'll bring you a closer look at politics, technology, health, and so much more, backed by VOA correspondents across Africa and the world, including perspectives from Washington, D.C., and Africans achieving abroad.
Same time, same channels.
Stay tuned.
We're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
It's time for Our Voices.
This is Straight Talk Africa on the Voice of America. What is your opinion about today's topic? Call us at 202-619-3111. U.S. country code 1. When you call, remember the following. Ask only one question. Keep your comment brief and turn down the volume on your radio or television. Now let's return to Straight Talk Africa.
Thank you very much, Esther, and we appreciate all of the audience feedback. Straight Talk Africa streams live every Wednesday on Facebook. You can watch our show there and leave a comment. Now let's look at what's on tap for next week's program.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, South African voters will cast their ballots on May 8th to elect a National Assembly and provincial legislators. This will be the sixth election since the end of apartheid and will determine the nation's next president. South Africans at the polls on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Today we are discussing the significance of a free press in Africa. Our guest, Professor Nicholas Bowers. He teaches at the Department of Communications at the University of the District of Columbia, and John Temin, Director of the Africa Program at Freedom House. To what extent is there freedom at Freedom House, John Temin?
Is there freedom at Freedom House?
Yes, please.
We think there's a great deal of freedom in our organization and in our reviews of countries around the world through our flagship Freedom in the World report every year.
And for that, I have to say once again that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host the two of you on Straight Talk Africa.
Happy to be here.
You're most welcome. What is the report card like, really?
Concerning freedom of the press in Africa, it's a mixed picture, as it is with the broader democracy and governance picture. And just like in our Freedom in the World report, some of the countries that have made the biggest gains this year, those countries are also seeing the biggest gains in terms of media freedoms. I would highlight in particular Ethiopia, mm-hmm. which is undergoing such a remarkable transition. Things could still go backwards, but some very positive things going on. The opening of political space and the opening of media space there has allowed a number of journalists to return, including some diaspora journalists previously based in the United States. It also means that for the first time in 10 years, there are no journalists in prison in Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. Ethiopia used to be one of the leaders in jailing journalists on the continent. Those days appear to be over for now, which is quite encouraging. Another country that has made massive strides democratically recently is the Gambia, and we're seeing those kind of improvements in press freedoms as well. But then you also have the other end of the spectrum, countries that are authoritarian in nature and behave that way in terms of their treatment of the media as well.
For example,
I would highlight Sudan in particular, which of course is undergoing its own remarkable transition right now. But over the course of these protests over the last few months, dozens of journalists have been arrested, which is a typical strategy for the Sudanese regime over many years. I would look at Cameroon as well, where many journalists were harassed over the course of the elections last year, which were so problematic and highlighted such great divides between Anglophone and Francophone Cameroon. There was also a very lengthy shutdown of internet services in Anglophone Cameroon. And of course, internet access is increasingly part of the conversation in terms of press freedoms.
Very interesting. Nicholas, there have been reports, for example, suggesting that some African countries, and quite perhaps a number of them, are among the fastest growing economies. And yet, when it comes to the issue of freedoms, there is a very huge question mark. Former U.S. President Barack Obama at one time noted that even with prosperity, without freedoms, it is a fundamental form of poverty.
It's true.
Do you agree with him?
I agree totally.
Why?
Why? Simply because I think, as I said earlier, if there's free press and free communication that is not stifled, people are able to come to an agreement, because communication is part of us. And because of the concept of self, which really we come from different life experiences, your values, whatever. So your thinking may be different from the other person. So I think communication offers a platform where people can disagree, but come to a sense when they manage those conflicts. And the free press and free expression does help to do that, because nobody gets like 1 + 1 = 2. This is social interaction where people differ in our behavior, our values, and we need to talk. And disagreeing is part of that, which is excellent. I think it builds more in terms of really getting understanding of what should be done then. How can we manage? You lose a little bit, I lose a little bit, we get in the middle, we move on, because nobody gets everything right. And that cannot help people to really be subjective and decide, like, this is the way to go. That's not the way to go. But people have to talk and, in the end, resolve what you think is meaningful to all of us. So the communication in this sense here, or the brief press, in the end, brings what? Product in the end of the discussion. You have a product, it's not a waste of time. It's not shouting, it's not putting people in jail or something like that. There must be that free communication that can ward off all these things that are very personal experience that is not my experience. Your experience is your experience. My experience is mine. So we may differ in between. So can we talk about it and find a way to minimize those conflicts? Because until this world comes to an end, there will always be conflict. There will always be disagreement. So I don't understand when people step for the media or cut these communication channels to people to be able to chip in what is good for them, for their country, for their development, and how things should be done. And of course, the media is an independent organization that really strikes the balance, offers that platform for people to say, and then in the end, of course, we can get a meaningful agreement that is productive to all of us.
John, what about some people who say, wait a minute, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, democracy are not reflected in people's stomachs, are not reflected in African villages and all that kind of stuff. Democracy is not reflected in people's stomachs. That what you actually need, in their view, is service delivery.
Well, I think there's a couple aspects to that. I think, first of all, there's still a lot of data out there that suggests that Africans broadly support democracy as the best form of governance. And I say that based largely on polling from the Afrobarometer organization, which, as you know, is a very reputable organization run by Africans that has been doing polling in dozens of countries across the continent for many years. But I also want to add a recent finding from Afrobarometer, which is quite concerning, which shows declining levels of support among Africans for free media. So this most recent survey, which they did in 31 countries, shows 47% of Africans, 46% of Africans surveyed saying media should be free to publish, but 49% are saying government should have the right to prevent publication. And that's striking. And there's a real decline in that support for free media across a number of countries. I can't explain in particular where that's coming from, but that general trend of declining popular support for media freedom is worrisome, because if that isn't there, it makes it even harder for the champions of free media to make the case that this is what people want, this is in the best interests of society.
How do we know that that is in fact an accurate or a true reflection of public opinion on the African continent?
You're never going to get a perfect reflection, but personally, having participated in setting up and running these surveys in the past, I know that it's a very high-quality endeavor and that there are a lot of checks and balances built into the process along the way. Certainly, there's a margin of error and there are limits to what you can do. But in general, there's a trend going on here that I think is indisputable.
But can I add something?
Sure.
Yeah, I agree. I do research. I teach communication research. But sometimes the problem of these data and research itself, as you interview people or you collect their views, sometimes is the sampling size could be a problem. How do you sample these people? Now, that's an issue that always bothers me.
Because what about the political environment?
That's where I'm coming from. You never know. Maybe large sample of those people were pretty much of that political party. So how do you get representative findings that are reasonably fair. So while it's okay, we deal into research, we follow those things, but there is a problem in terms also of how do you formulate those questions on that survey, whatever. Because sometimes there's this element of self where you may craft a question that favors your interest. And that's very hard to take it from the self to like general outlook. So there is a problem. So there are limitations to these literature that really people may ask, why is that trend? Why is it going this way? And for me, that is very striking to see that many African people want the government to control. I haven't heard that. I mean, this is my first time here. But I see, when I go to these African countries, I see a lot of people, young people, really, you know, vibrantly walking. You observe them. You see, they want really free expression. They want the media to report. They want to. There's no harm, except maybe for the government that fears sometimes they...
Because the young people perhaps are not invested in the status quo.
Probably it's true.
Let's be a little bit democratic and set some examples here of being a bit inclusive. And by that I mean let's go to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Emmanuel from Nigeria. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Good evening, Shaka. How are you?
I am hugely terrific. How are you, Emmanuel?
Well, very, very fine. Longest time.
Where are you calling from?
I am calling from Nigeria, Edo State.
Edo State?
Edo State, Edo State, Nigeria.
What is your question? What is your question or comment, Emmanuel? I'm afraid. Let me come to you, John. What about people who ask and actually wonder whether, for example, this thing called democracy and the service delivery are mutually exclusive, or are they in fact mutually reinforcing?
There certainly exists a strand of thinking that it takes an authoritarian in order to reform a society, in order to do what's necessary to make changes, to deliver services, and so forth.
And which are some of the successful examples? So, for example,
well, I would question that, frankly. Everybody points to Rwanda and what President Kagame has done.
Has it in fact delivered?
I'm not so sure about that. There's some evidence out there that the numbers that are used for Rwanda are questionable. And you have to look at the whole package, and the whole package includes the daily freedoms that people enjoy and the liberties that they enjoy.
Those are absent.
So
I have, in fact, met some people, including some of those who have worked on Rwanda for some of these Bretton Woods institutions, and the evidence seems to be that we are looking at a situation where, in fact, some of the results are reflections, probably, of creative accounting.
There is certainly that accusation. but you know, when a democracy is functioning well, there is a proper feedback loop, and that feedback loop allows citizens, based on the services they receive and the benefits they receive from government, to have their say in whether their elected leaders get to continue in their job. And so that is how it's supposed to function. And some countries have gotten to that place where they are willing to eject leaders from their positions based on lack of service delivery. Particularly in recent years, there is a remarkable turnover of leadership in Africa. Since 2015, there are 26 new leaders, more than half the continent in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yes.
Now, some of those are handovers, you know, within the party from one leader to another, but more than half of those are opposition parties coming into power. That says something. That says that people are willing to vote out the old guys who aren't doing the job.
That is, of course, if in fact you do have elections that are credible, that are fair and free, transparent and verifiable, and whose results, as a matter of fact, reflect the will of the people, not the will of those individuals who count the vote.
And I'd like to add something. What you're saying here, Shaka, is that authoritarian is said to be efficient because you order people, you club them, they do what you want them to do, and they'll do it. And it may look like, oh, it's good. But democracy takes time. It's effective in the end because people, as you said, participate and see where they go. And if there's anything wrong, they come back to the drawing table and talk about it. And that's the nature of life. It cannot be somebody imposing his will. And that's what we have really problem around the world. These things do not work that way. You impose on people, it doesn't really work that much.
You know as well as I do that there used to be many military coups, as a matter of fact, successful military coups in Africa. But the international community decided that if, in fact, you should seize power with an AK-47.
Yes.
It is no longer going to conduct business as usual with you. What about the fact that some African leaders have become very, very, very smart in the sense that they no longer have to seize power with an AK-47, but they actually can seize power with, for example, conducting an election that, in fact, in other people's words, is a selection.
Yeah.
An election that they cannot lose. Not because people are voting for them, but because they essentially impose themselves upon people. And also you have a situation where presidents, for example, are sworn into power on the basis of a constitution. A constitution that they swear to defend, to protect and to preserve. But what about the fact that you are seeing a lot of situations where these constitutions are almost being transformed into personal manifestos?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Where is the international community's stand on this? Because frankly, this is another way of a sort of military coup.
Yeah. What you're getting at, in part, is the difference between the form and the function of democracy. A lot of countries, most countries, now go along with the form of having elections every few years.
They say,
but in terms of the
periodic elections.
Right, but in terms of the function, the essence of democracy.
But are those elections really?
In many cases, no. And in many cases, there's a huge thumb on the scale behind the scenes that clearly favors the incumbent.
Right.
And what about some people, John, who say that some of these elections that we're actually talking about are basically meant for the appeasement of the development partners, but not the primary stakeholders in those countries?
I think there's a valid argument there in some countries. Let's be selective about which countries we're talking about, but I think in some cases, yes, leaders know that they have to, on a superficial level, play by the rules of having those periodic elections. What happens between those elections and what happens even behind the scenes of those elections is clearly anti-democratic. Let me come back to your point as well concerning coups. And you're right that this norm of condemning coups has developed over the years, and the African Union has actually done a very strong job so far of maintaining that norm. However, as we speak, there's a real test of that going on in Sudan, which is very clearly a coup. You can have a debate as to whether it was a productive coup or even a good coup, but it was a coup nonetheless.
What about Zimbabwe?
Zimbabwe is the other example right before that.
What about Egypt?
Egypt is another example, too. Of course, now we have President El-Sisi as head of the African Union, which complicates things. But so far, nobody has called what has happened in Sudan a coup, and the African Union is wavering in terms of what it's required to do, which is suspend any country that has a coup. And now, first they said, well, you have 15 days to have a civilian-led government. Now they've said you have 2 months to have a civilian-led government. They're getting a little bit soft in terms of the commitment to firmly opposing coups on the continent.
Didn't they call for what they said was the restoration of constitutional order?
Right. We can have a debate as to whether constitutional order was truly the case under President Bashir. And, you know, that gets to your other important point as well, in the way that some constitutions are being manipulated in order to benefit leaders. And certainly we see that especially in countries that are trying to change term limits in order to benefit the incumbent. There are a number of those examples. There appears to be a new one coming in Guinea, where President Conde is showing a lot of signs of planning to change the constitution so that he can run for a third term. And that really does question the foundational nature of those constitutional documents and the firmness of leaders' commitments to upholding them.
Do you still call those documents constitutions, or are they, in fact, as some people have suggested, documents that, in fact, have been transformed into some sort of personal manifesto?
Yeah, they've been doctored and, you know, all sort of things that to favor whatever they want.
But there are two things to freedom. For one thing is when you have a constitution, you expect that you have citizens who owe allegiance to the state and therefore have, in fact, constitutional rights. Some might say inalienable rights, birthrights, for that matter. Something really that is reflective of the Magna Carta. But when you do not have those types of circumstances, you are a subject owing allegiance to an individual authority. It could be a presidential monarch. It could be a king, an emperor, or a dictator, or whatever. What do Africans need to do in order to qualify as citizens in their own countries so that they are, in fact, the bosses, really, rather than the other way around?
This is where we are talking about the free press. I mean, that's a big tool that will help them to get what is necessary here in terms of speaking openly and challenging those ideas that are really anti-democratic. that they don't involve them, because this is part of the involvement. Everybody has got to be involved. Everybody has got to play here in a way that they can be successful. But you're not playing simply because you want to be a leader, a very subject leader, who imposes on others. So, and that's why we're here today, at least revisiting this topic that has been spoken many times with different people, but that there's less inroad in many African countries to do what they're required to do, and that is to open up and bring people together as they talk, so at least you can hear, and leaders can move them to a right direction, other than just imposing and stifling the issues that are significant to them, and saying that yours maybe are better than them. So I think that's what maybe people in Africa need to keep going and pursuing their free speech, freedom of speech and the press, so that there can be accountability that is open for people to really do something that is meaningful.
Accountability, indeed. Let's go again to the lifeline of the show, which are the telephone callers. Good evening, Samuel from Uganda. You're most welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Good evening, Shaka. How are you after a long, long time?
I am hugely terrific after a very long, long time, Samuel.
And let me straight away go to the panelists. How is Abiy Ahmed going to ensure that the situation which we are seeing in Sudan will not escalate to Ethiopia? And what is the message of the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is going to give to the African leaders to ensure that the constitution progress in Africa will not be tampered with, and leaders in Africa will not shift the constitutional goalposts, because what we are seeing now is that there is a constitutional tampering with by the African leaders, which we don't want to see in Ethiopia. Thank you, Shaka Sali, and please, I will get in touch with you. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Sam. Are you still calling from Ruti in southwestern Uganda?
I'm afraid.
Very interesting. Well, how do you respond to that, John?
I think the question of Prime Minister Abiy's ability to exert influence outside of his borders is a really important one, because right now in East Africa and the Horn, in my view, he is the only leader who is really trying to advance democratic governance. And he's having a hard time in some ways.
And for that matter, could it be, as a matter of fact, that perhaps the Sudanese people who got into this business of protests and what have you could probably, just probably, have borrowed a leaf from Ethiopia?
Well, except that Sudan has a long and proud history of protests. Sudan changed its government through protests in 1964 and 1985, and yeah. Sudanese will very quickly remind you of that fact.
General Ibrahim Aboud.
Yes.
University students, as a matter of fact.
They know how to protest. Yeah. They may well have been inspired by the protests in Ethiopia that did lead to such change and were so sustained over 2 years.
Over 2 years.
So there may well be some learning and some cross-border inspiration going on there. Prime Minister Abiy has already been very active within the region, both in terms of peacemaking with Eritrea, and he's gotten a little bit involved in South Sudan peacemaking, and he's tried to mediate a dispute between Kenya and Somalia. Whether he will try to exert influence in Sudan, I think, remains to be seen. There's a lot of other countries, particularly countries from the Gulf and Egypt and Turkey, who are already flexing their muscles in Sudan, and the worry is that Sudan is quickly becoming a pawn in a broader game going on. And it would be very good to see more African leadership on the questions about the future of Sudan. And I think Prime Minister Abiy is probably one of the people whose voice would be most valuable.
Very interesting. Let me ask you an interesting question here, given that you come from the United Republic of Tanzania. Tanzania has the distinction, at least in many people's eyes, of being the harbor of peace, just like its commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. What is it like in Tanzania today in terms of freedoms?
Well, I think there's freedom to a certain extent where people go around doing their business, whatever. But lately, way back, I think I heard some of these organizations were closed, the media, something like that. So as we are talking, I think there needs to be this approach in which then the government can really be a part of their development and enhancing the press, the free press, by you getting to convene a meeting and be able to talk with the media and the people and try to find something that is reasonable instead of just accusation every now and then, whatever. I think there's still there's a chance to succeed in that way. If there's collective agreement where people can sit together and iron those differences, and then we can move forward. And if anything does work, we come back. They should come back and talk about it and try to resolve some of these things. I think at the end, as I said, at the end of our communication, we should be productive, not unproductive, because there's a waste of time, waste of money, and all that stuff. So I think there's still hope, and I think they can work out and resolve some of these issues that have been there for quite some time.
We talk about the need, and indeed the compelling need for press freedom, and for freedoms, for that matter, freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and you name it, and stuff like that. But when it comes to freedom of press, does it necessarily reflect the quality of journalism?
That's probably a better question for Professor Nicholas here, who's the journalism professor.
Yeah, I think it does. It does very well, because, look...
when reporters Without Borders, for example, are coming out with these indexes and all that kind of stuff, ranking, you know, the degree or levels of freedom of press in countries...
Yeah.
Are they mindful of the quality of journalism, for example, in that broad context?
I'm not sure about that. But
because
that is
something that sometimes government authorities complain about.
Yeah, okay, but I would say that I think journalists need to be able, first of all, to report correctly and write well so people can follow that. Because some of these journalists, whatever, too many, do not have the ability.
The education,
exactly.
The training
to be able to write effectively where people can really follow and understand, because writing is hard. And you need to have the skills of writing, so when you bring an issue, okay, when people read, they can really understand and get to the point where you want, you want them to see. So if you have just, because this has been a trend, when you have everybody is a journalist, everybody is doing that, there's a lot of distortion and a lot of incorrect, you know, things that are being reported. So I think there needs to be something to sharpen the skills of these journalists, so at least we can get something that's fair.
What about the issue of poor remuneration of journalists?
It could be also part of that, because probably they're not even paid well, and sometimes, and because of that.
And couldn't that perhaps contribute to the issue of quote unquote brown envelopes?
I guess so. Yeah, because sometimes some of these leaders, whatever, they'll call them and then they give them that brown envelope and say, write something for me that is, you know, that will pay me good.
Some of these journalists, because of being paid poorly and what have you,
yeah,
There are some people who think that they tend to abdicate their responsibility, their obligation. And in fact become sorts of public relations agents of those that have the money.
That's what I was saying. It's true. That has happened, and it was reported many times. And so they advocate the journalist principles of balanced and fair reporting. That's what
How do you address that issue?
How do you address that issue?
Yeah.
I think those
who have media houses in Africa sometimes, I have been told, who do not really pay, for example.
It's true.
They're journalists. They're workers for months and months.
Yeah. So it's true. So, and that's the way maybe through these brown envelopes, that's where they get there. They pay or survival because they get the organization doesn't pay them. So they go with that route of trying to be PR for a particular organization. Those organizations then pay them, and so they survive. But it's truly that payment for the journalists is not good. Is feeble. Is very low, and so they lose morale, and they tend to be PR officers of a particular organization. So that's really dangerous.
John, to what extent is there a correlation between, for example, democracy and freedom of press?
Oh, I think it's a very direct relationship.
A very direct relationship.
Absolutely, and I think you can see in our Freedom in the World ratings and the work that Reporters Without Borders and others do, that countries often move in unison in terms of both democracy writ large and freedom of the press. To build on what you guys were just talking about, what I think is particularly important here is investigative journalism.
Right.
And I think there really are some increasing investigative journalism skills in Africa now, which is so important. Look for, in particular, at South Africa, the subject of your show next week. Investigative journalism was so important in uncovering state capture and the massive corruption that happened under former President Zuma, which led to such pressure for the change and led to the rise of President Ramaphosa.
South Africa happens to be the exception and not the rule on the African continent in terms of democracy. You're not only talking about the manner in which the press functions, but it also happens to have a fiercely independent judiciary system.
That's right.
Look at a country like Ghana. There is some remarkable investigative journalism going on in Ghana as well. Now, unfortunately, that has had some repercussions. There was earlier this year an investigative journalist murdered for his work in Ghana, which is deeply concerning in a country that generally is democratic.
Correct.
But I think there's good investigative journalism developing across the continent.
There is. But when you talk about, again, the correlation between the relationship between democracy and the free press, how do you reconcile that, for example, with the case of Singapore under Lee Kuan Yew and Malaysia under Muhammad Mahathir?
Those are examples from some time ago, and the world has changed. Look, we're in a place right now where democracy is broadly accepted as the best form of government. And we have data, again, going back to some of what we talked about before, that Africans broadly support democracy over any other form of government. It's messy, it takes time, as Professor Nicholas was talking about. But those examples, those, you know, East Asian tigers, as they're called, had a relevance at a time in a particular context. I think it's largely irrelevant today in Africa.
Well, Churchill would have agreed with you, even though he said it was the worst form of government except for the others. Well, on that note, our guests were Professor Nicholas Boas, John Temin, and VOA Director Amanda Bennett, who joined us earlier. Thanks to our audience for tuning into Straight Talk Africa. In the meantime, get better, not bitter, Africa. And please remember to keep the African hopes alive. Yeah.